It's a mini episode.
Hello and welcome to another mini episode of You Gotta Check This Out with Mike and Dre. I'm the Mike, and today I'm bringing you some excerpts from the previous episode with Evan Stitely. Evan and I are both musicians and got into a deeper discussion comparing music to writing. Then, Dre takes us through his theory on JMS's plot trap doors. We check in with him after Evan reveals she has been illustrating comics and working on her first graphic novel.
I guess if you're doing comics, what kind of comics are you into? What do you read that got you deep into enough to want to create some of your own?
Yeah, so initially it was mostly like manga and like Japanese stuff. But I've recently been getting more into like indie stuff from the West. I haven't checked out too much Marvel and DC, which I know you're a big fan of.
Yeah, I'm kind of an omnivore when it comes to that. But yeah, a lot of Image stuff and mostly Marvel is my past.
Sweet, sweet. Yeah, but that's mostly what got me into it. It's funny because lately I've been thinking about how art intersects with propaganda and how like all art is a form of propaganda and like packaging a concept or an idea or philosophy and then sending it off to people to experience. Mm-hmm. And when I was studying jazz and being really hardcore about that and getting to the super out New York scene, I started realizing that like the only people I'm really going to be reaching if I go into the esoteric jazz world is other jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find mediums that were a little more accessible to the general public. And I found that comics are just, I love visual mediums. I love the abstraction you can get from illustration as opposed to just prose. Not to say that prose can't have its own abstraction, its own beauty, but it just touched me in a specific way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I've always loved about the medium of comics as opposed to, you know, we've been going through so much television lately on this show, mm-hmm. is just how much more control you would have as the single author of a graphic novel or a story. It's a whole different set of responsibilities, it seems, because as opposed to being like if we use a Babylon 5 with JMS being the showrunner, the writer of everything, he has so much to plan for every season. He wanted to plan to write Babylon 5 like a novel in five seasons, which hadn't really been on TV. And a lot of what you have to do to have an ongoing story for that long is things have to stay stable over time. And especially, you know, in the early 90s when Babylon 5 was getting going, serialized storytelling just was seen as something that you couldn't do in the television media.
So, Mike, I was going to see, can I cut in with the lame music metaphor as a non-musician? I took piano lessons till I was like 14, but I didn't take them seriously. So Mike knows the type of student that, you know, never practices, and it's very obvious. So I can barely remember scales at this point. But, you know, the jokey note about jazz is it's all about the notes you don't play right, and it's all about improv. And I think that actually relates a lot, actually. So, you know, as we mentioned, we're going through Babylon 5. You probably heard my voice on the intro that Mike has hopefully edited to sound beautiful. And we are wrapping up season one, and we did have like...
You always sound beautiful to me, Dre.
Oh, thanks, Mike.
I mean, for context, I spent most of my formative years locked in a small room practicing drums, so I missed, like, every pop culture thing that happened for the first, I don't know, 20 years of my life. So I'm playing catch-up now.
It's a good cause. Just playing the drums is kind of noble.
Last tangent before we get on to, like, the flashback to Babylon 5, Mike. So what was Whiplash like for you watching them?
Me?
Yeah.
Or, no.
Or have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes. Whiplash, this is how I've described it, is that it's a sports movie with the aesthetic of a music movie.
Good one.
And it's a wonderful movie from like a film perspective. From like a representation of what it's like to be a jazz musician,
I've known a couple teachers kind of like that, but nowhere near to that. You know, it's heightened for the movie.
What age group listens to this podcast? Like, what am I allowed to mention? Drugs, is that allowed?
Yeah, we okay, have no cool. You can swear if you want, it's okay.
My experience with like jazz cats who teach, 90% of them are the type who like smoke some weed before their lesson and then like, oh guys, like, oh, check out this sick voicing, you know. It's not so much throw a chair at someone and say, oh, not my tempo, you know. And also playing fast is not the mark of the most killing musician. It's that's probably the least important thing is if you can go da 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 on the symbol or whatever.
Yeah, which is more dexterity than just straight up
Yeah.
speed anyway, as
But
you get
it'd
to.
be boring. It would be boring for a general audience to genuinely watch what it's like for a jazz musician to practice, because it'd be like doing something super slow for a week and then going like 10 beats per minute faster the next week. It's like, no one, that's not compelling
Exciting stuff,
cinema. So it's
yeah.
like, I get it. You got to make the guy bleed. You got to make him like having a breakdown. I totally, I think that's
You
probably
have
a
to play
good choice.
Caravan at the end because
Yeah,
that's going to be the most exciting.
absolutely. Of course. Yeah. So,
So yeah, if we can just talk a little bit too about music since we're back on drums a little bit. One thing I wanted to ask you about, Evan, is I know you're a multifaceted artist by now, whether that's what you set out to do or not. And I wanted to hear a little bit about like how you compare going from playing music, which is, it's a collaborative activity for the most part. You're probably not going out and just playing drums and busking with that by yourself a lot of times. Although
No, certainly
you're
not.
prerogative, which you could. But so it's very collaborative. Like we were in a practice group together for a while. We were half forming a band before I know something happened to your hand and you couldn't drum as much anymore. I was just very curious since I've heard you're writing a graphic novel, I'm very interested in like how you compare that, like going from a collaborative medium to something where you have to go back to like what you're saying, the first 20 years where you're just shedding in your bedroom for a while, except now that is the craft where you're the one person in control of everything. Could you talk a little bit about, tell me what it's like to have to go from music to drawing like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, my relationship with drawing, or maybe the fundamental reason behind why I do it, is almost the opposite of music. Or I started when I got passionate about music, it was the process that I was in love in. I was just in love with like the act of hearing sounds around me and then formulating sounds that complement those sounds. Like that was it was just the act of doing that. There was never like a project that I was going towards or like a thing I was trying to say or like a philosophy I was trying to express. I think those things like inadvertently came out because, like any art form anyone does inherently is going to have shades of them as a person shine through in that art. And at the, so, it was all process for music. Whereas when I started learning to draw and write and things, it was all for the purpose of this project, this graphic novel idea that I had, right? So like I have like an 8-year plan. First, I was like, okay, so first I'm gonna study storytelling for 2 years, then I'm gonna storyboard for 2 years, then I'm gonna study illustration 2 years, then I'm gonna work 2 years on the final product, which is deeply different than the music thing. And like music has been an avenue to study visual art in the sense of like discipline and awareness of the body and of the mind. But that's not, I'm getting away from the question you asked. Collaborative
That's okay.
versus
No, it all
solo.
ties together. I like it.
I've always just been like the drummer in the band, when I was in music. And so I very much was passionate about making other people's visions come to fruition. And so I loved being in that supporting role. And I'm not going to get deep into my personal life on a podcast, so I don't need this to be my therapy
No
session.
worries. That's not what it's
But
about, is it?
yeah, I've been a supporting role for most of my life in a lot of ways, and I really love that. That's a thing I feel passionate about. And telling stories is the first time I've ever been like, oh, here's something that I want to say, and I want it to be as like unadulterated and like, for lack of a better term, like pure or distilled as I can make it.
Oh no, I
Which
can
is,
definitely see that. Yeah.
yeah. So it's like, in music, I don't like playing drum solos. Like, I don't like when the band drops out and it's just me, because I'm like, the whole only reason I like playing music is because I like bouncing off of other people,
Yeah.
Whereas with stories, I am protective to a level where it's like, sometimes when someone pitches something, I'm like, damn it, that's such a good idea that I can't use now, because I'm so, specific about it coming from my brain,
Oh no, that's
All right.
completely
This
how I
is
look at music too, because like as
too.
a bass player, that's all I want to do is support everybody else. I mean, I was just playing a gig last weekend where at the end of a blues we're just doing a blues thing and the guy's like, "Oh, Mike Slater on bass." I'm like, "Oh, we didn't talk about this. You're the guitarist. I'm supporting you." Just walk for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm really curious how the CGI in this show ages if you didn't grow up with it, and or like Mike, I'm assuming you and me, we were used to like Star Trek models, so this was a step up at the time, although nowadays it's interesting.
Yeah, I've always been someone who values story over spectacle. I really don't care how something looks. Like, if something is gorgeous and like a pleasure to look at, that's a plus. And at the same time, like, I don't know, I don't need it to look convincing. I didn't have any problems with it. I mean, it looked,
It told the tale.
I could tell what was going on very clearly, and there was nothing that took me out of the experience of watching it. You know what I
Yeah.
mean?
The
And that's
only
usually
thing
what I
that's,
care.
you know, not to go on a too big tangent, but the only thing the medium that's taken me out of that mentality a little bit has been comics over the ages. Because, like, when I first started reading comics, I was kind of like a writer snob. Like, oh, I don't care who the artist is at all. I only care about, like, the story in on it. But, like, certain artist and writer pairings like can really bring each other up to a much higher level than neither of them could have done on their own. And same thing with you know, when I was a kid just writing music all the time, I like poo-pooed lyrics all the time side of it until later on in life, but I was like, oh yeah, that's the key. Nothing is going to be a song that sits with people unless you can have really good lyrics to match with that music.
Yeah,
So
I think like visuals and story are multiplicative. Like, they're both at base one. And if you have a fantastic story and like fine visuals, you're still gonna have that high number on the story, and the visuals won't necessarily take away from it. You can also have visuals that totally take you out, and that'd be like a 0.5, and that would half the story or whatever mathematically you want to say. And then when you, like you said, there's like a pairing where it's like then it goes up exponentially, you know.
And that's almost like the mysticism of finding that right pair. It's very difficult to like even express what makes two different people sing together like that, so to speak. But you know, it's like you know it when you see it, and something really hit you hard.
Yeah,
I
so
am
to get back to
definitely.
the original question. Oh, please, please.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
I was definitely going to ask in terms of that pairing, your opinion also though on the music of this because they did have Christopher Frank do like an orchestra accompaniment to it. And sometimes it doesn't always pair great, but like that scene is an example. You know, I can hear the Babylon 5 theme song playing as it's getting destroyed, and that does seem to work.
I'll be honest with you. When I was watching, I was trying to kind of hyper focus on the story and the characters because I have a pretty tough memory. So I was like, my nightmare is getting on here. You're going, what do you think of this scene? I'm like, oh, what scene? So I don't think I quite, the music kind of slipped past me a little bit, which is funny to say as someone who like historically can't focus on anything other than music if there is any music. But I didn't find myself, which again, like if we're talking multiplicative where you've got like the music, the visuals, the story. I felt like for me, the music and the visuals were a one, and the story was like whatever number the story was. Where it's like, I didn't feel like any of it took away. And I didn't personally, and this is probably just because I was a little nervous about like talking about my experience of it on a podcast, but I didn't notice as much the music. So it didn't really take me out, and it didn't necessarily elevate it. But again, if I was watching it in like a vacuum casually,
Yeah.
maybe it would have, you
I
know?
think that, well, some of the best soundtrack music just sits there in the background and doesn't really permeate you. It's like what we were talking about earlier, being a drummer and a bassist, we have to play in those roles. You want to support the other people in the band. And I think in this case, the music doesn't really come out aside from, you know, the main couple themes once in a while. It shoots out when it does need to, but it's there as a bed to let everything else sing over it.
So I don't know if that it's a funny point where you notice that. Like if you notice it's there, it's not doing its job,
Yeah,
which is
absolutely.
so rough when you're just like, and I do appreciate that, you know, you both recognize that where there are glue things that are required for things to be good. But I'll take it. And we did have a side thing we were going to talk about, which was Michael O'Hare, trapdoors, and you know, I'm going to call JMS a jazz musician of showrunners because he had to basically plan a 5-season arc, which is very stable, very controlled, like music, but then make it very flexible. Notes that aren't there, like we literally lose Michael O'Hare right after this episode. So, and actually, Evan, I was really curious, were you aware of that? The captain, so you said you've seen the first episode of the season and the last. Are you aware that after this episode, that captain is gone?
The one that was like on the medical deck, you're saying?
The
That's the
player,
no,
the
that's
main
the
captain,
security. That's the security leader. You're talking about like the, oh,
the
I've got his
big,
name
like the
right here.
main, the Picard of the series, the guy
Yeah,
who's
Jeffrey
leading the entire
Sinclair,
thing.
right?
Yeah, Sinclair.
He's
Yep.
just gone after that?
He's gone after
Whoa,
that
that's
episode you
out.
watched.
Yeah,
Yeah.
okay.
So this is kind of what we were discussing as for the topic is sometimes when you're planning a long season of television, you have to make trap doors, as JMS called them, because what happens if one of your, say, lead characters gets another show halfway through and has to go for contracts? What if your show is canceled halfway through and you have to all of a sudden have two episodes to wrap up a plot you were planning on going for five seasons for? So this literally happened to Babylon 5 right after the episode you saw.
That's really interesting. Is talking about how they handled that within the purview of this episode, or is that a
It
future?
definitely is.
This is one of the wildest, and I even though I said you were going to run it, Mike, I'll try
No, I'm
and do
definitely
this
letting
quick.
you talk about this because, like, every chance
Ah,
Dre gets to talk about what happened to Sinclair, like, hey, Mike, did I ever tell you what happened to Sinclair? Like,
yeah.
yeah, Dre, I guess you can
It's
tell me what
true.
happened to
I
Sinclair
text him in the
again.
middle of the night about it. It's
Do we get a new voice of reason or?
It's like, brrrr. Mike, have you heard about Sinclair?
Anyway, so I mean, the key thing is actually he was struggling with a mental illness and was hallucinating on set and really could not hold it together. And it became apparent about midway through the show. And they decided to quietly write him off so that the show could both keep going and that Michael O'Hare's career would not get damaged if he was able to recover. And might have made like a partial recovery and then later kind of fell off and recently passed away. And so we only got to find out after his death. But essentially, the lead actor was not capable of acting in the show anymore. And the entire plot arc that JMS had, as Mike said, 5 years had tied around this character, he was basically going to have to say he's leaving. And he had to do it in a very clever way. And I will throw this out, there is a DVD commentary on this episode where he is keeping kayfabe for the wrestling folk out there. JMS, 5 years after this wrapped, did come out and say, oh, yeah, Michael, he wanted to go do theater, and we decided this was too much, and we decided to go a different direction, and it just all worked out. But just absolutely wild that he had this long arc and was able to work around literally the worst thing that could go wrong, your lead actor going down halfway through the first season.
Did they relate that narratively to the partner, like the partner that he had that kind of came back in the story, or was it was just like a separate thing that made him leave in
Yes, they
universe?
took a very because for the whole first season they were setting up a lot about Sinclair and the Minbari, where he had this intertwined Minbari, which eventually was going to go that he was a Minbari in a past life,
Oh, interesting.
or like in a
Cool.
future life. I think how they go to. You know more about that, Dre, but I'm going to leave it at that for now. He had ways to kind of bring is Michael O'Hara back later on in other seasons. So as because. He was having hallucinations, which is fascinating to go back and watch season one again, knowing, oh my gosh, this actor who was like sometimes in plots where his mind was being controlled by, some alien or being shown, hallucinations, like he was really going through that in real life at the same time.
Hardcore method.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez.
As hardcore as you can get on
I don't know
that.
if that's a good joke or too soon. That's to straddle that nice line.
Hey, that's what you brought me on for.
Exactly. Did you mention Dre though that like how long he kept the secret for? Because at first, like you were saying, like they said like, oh yeah, he went off and did other things in the first 5 years, but they waited until like after Michael O'Hara actually passed away to actually reveal the full truth, which was pretty recent, right?
Yeah, it was
Whoa.
2013, and that's one other. Yeah, that's a tangent for another intro show, Mike, but another wild thing is just the number of people related to the show that have passed away since it's come on. But I was curious if you wanted to say, anything else about like trapdoors, O'Hare, just how this show was written, because I do think that's a fascinating aspect of it, and it's really cool to see that, new people seeing the show weren't even
There is
aware.
one episode in particular, Babylon Squared, where they really set up some future things around Sinclair. And even at that time, I mean, that was episode 20, like 2 episodes for the end. Like JMS had to be aware at that point that he was going to have to leave the show, I mean, at least for a little while. But they still set up this plot where I guess we can go into like in Babylon Squared, they go to Babylon 4, which was the mysterious space station that disappeared before Babylon 5. They find it's warping in or phasing in somewhere, and Sinclair appears like a future version of himself to set up a timeline for season 2 and 3. And while they don't get to continue with Sinclair as the normal captain, they do get to pull him back to at least tie off that storyline. That's like a huge setup where if you didn't pay that off with Sinclair, it'd stick out like a sore thumb.
Or you'd have to go some route like, time is malleable, something changed in the timeline.
Well, actually, it's you're you you I okay. So first off, you and JMS could collaborate, and because what happened is in the original show, they show him briefly. So the captain we saw who ends the episode, Sinclair, in this flashback, we see him and he's aged. It's in the future, and we hear Delenn's voice off. It says it's time to go. So that happens. Now he's older. It's supposed to be in the future. Later, they wrap it up in a different way. Timeline's malleable. And the reason JMS gives is because there is time travel in the show. We've already established that. Because he has been traveling through the time rift, it's messing with his aging. And so, because he's in the future and he's gone to the past once, every time he tries to go, every time he jumps around, it's aging him. So, it's actually quite brilliant because, as Mike says, they wrap it up in the future. The author goes, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense with the continuity I set up, and says, wait a minute, here's what I'll say. I'll say he's getting messed around by jumping around the timeline, and the more he jumps around the timeline, the older he's going to get. He's only allowed to go back in time, Marty. He's not allowed to go forward. And you look young. Did the Marty line land, or does that make any sense?
Back to the Future?
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Okay, cool.
If you're like Rick and Morty, is it
No,
Morty, which
no,
is based
no.
on
Great.
The
My kids
context.
are like 9 and 14, and they both would get that reference.
Well, they're
All
your
right.
kids, though. That's
Okay.
to be
All
fair.
right. All right. Fair enough. As you were saying, JMS starts highly collaborative on a lot of shows. And actually, go back and listen to the last episode, which I still need to edit, Mike. Don't worry, it'll get to you soon. Where we
We
talk
have two
all about his
editors.
back.
Remember, that's our competitive advantage. You were the
Got the
two
two
editors.
editors. But anyway, so JMS does come from a collaborative background, working on shows like Ghostbusters, He-Man, etc. Babylon 5 is his baby, and he does everything. And it's one other weird thing. I do think we'll have to stick on Babylon 5 and go through, but a little more music there, which is when you're talking collaborative, it is his vision and his thing, but he's still, it sounds like he's a control freak and collaborative at the same time, which seems paradoxical. And I'm just going to bring up one tangent on that because it relates to what you two were just talking about. Bill Mumy on the show talked about how he acted on Star Trek. And when he acted on Star Trek, like, he changed the intonation of a word, and the director's like, you have to get it cleared to change that word. On Babylon 5, JMS is like, what I write is gospel. Do not change my writing. The stories of when someone was able to edit his script are like legendary because it's him trusting, but it's like that did not happen. But you listen to the people who talk about being on Babylon 5, and they're like, oh, it was a great time. I didn't feel constrained. Bill Mumy, et cetera, was like, yeah, Babylon 5 was fine. Star Trek was constrictive. And you're like, but wait, Star Trek is the one that was like different people each time. Babylon 5 with JMS was one person, one vision, and yet it was different.
And that's a wrap for this week. I think we're still in the clear. Dre never checks the feed and is still completely in the dark on these minisodes. Let's keep it that way. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next Sunday as we move on to Babylon 5, Season 2, Episode 3, The Geometry of Shadows, with special guest Jaina Mistry. Cheers, all.